4-7-5.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Crisis Center of West Texas has scheduled Art Against Assault, a community art show at 7 p.m. April 20th at Cactus House, 114 East 29th Street. Artists are invited to create pieces that promote consent, create conversation, and demand change. All mediums will be accepted as long as the art is on theme. Photography, music, songs, drawings, poetry, spoken word, paintings, mixed media, canvas, sculptures, collages, etc. Artists can remain anonymous if they wish to do so. Submissions are due by April 23rd. At bit.ly/artagainstassault. Art is due April 30th at Cactus House. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month.
Now here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 65 and clear. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. Then tomorrow mostly cloudy with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night a few showers with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This week it's our fourth reading from Entertainment Weekly's March issue, and it's going to be an interesting hodgepodge of things. I think I have a book review, we need to finish an article that we started last week, and I think we might hear a little bit about Billie Eilish. First, I'll start with our editor's letter. It's our weekly email that we get, and it starts out like this. Despite entertainment being my solace throughout this past year, there's one thing I haven't been great at keeping up with. That's Oscar contenders. Oscar films are their own breed, and for me, they're the type of movies that I really miss seeing in theaters. Yes, big blockbusters are fun to see with a crowd, but I love the feeling of sitting in a dark theater watching something that you know is going to stay with you for days afterward because it's that good. There's also the fact that it's hard for me to watch serious films alone on my couch in the middle of a global pandemic. The whole world is a drama. I don't need to watch one. Because, let's face it, Oscar films are nothing if not serious. This year in particular, I've turned to entertainment for a break from reality, a break from tears. But now that nominations have been announced, well, I guess it's time to start crying on my couch. What's been your favorite Oscar film this year? Until next week, Sam. And her Twitter address is @SamHighfill, SamHighfill. Here are five things to say at a virtual party. The best and worst news of the week. Number one, leather blazer sales skyrocket after Harry Styles' Grammy performance. Green feather boas, not so much. Number two, In the Heights reveals new trailer, injects hope back into viewers' souls. Number three, ABC announces two bachelorettes, unable to choose one despite the very premise of its show. Number four, Paramount Plus reveals the cast of The Challenge All-Stars, which features exactly four All-Stars and a whole bunch of people who've never won. And number five, Zack Snyder's Justice League had a virtual premiere that was delayed 6 hours. Perhaps they were hoping that after that wait, viewers would think the movie was short? What to watch? All your TV dilemmas sorted. March 19th, sees The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. WandaVision is over, and now it's time for Marvel's favorite buddy comedy, featuring Captain America's shield to shine. March 21st is The Simpsons. The Fox series is casually celebrating its 700th episode. Let that sink in. Genius, Aretha, is March 21st also on National Geographic. Cynthia Erivo stuns as the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, in this four-night television event. Demi Lovato, Dancing with the Devil, is March 23rd on YouTube. The Disney star-turned-powerhouse singer is ready to share her story, her way. And your binge is Superstore on Hulu. After 6 seasons, the comedy is coming to an end on March 25th, which means now is the perfect time to relive every joke. Here's our special guest staffer, what critic Darren French loves right now. His Twitter address is @DarrenFrench, DarrenFranich. And his pick is Halt and Catch Fire on Netflix. Charismatic IBM executive Joe McMillan, played by Lee Pace, arrives in the Dallas tech industry with big dreams, which he foists upon cynical engineer Gordon Clark, played by Scoot McNairy. They're a mythic Silicon duo, Jobsian visionary, Wozniakian wonk. But Fire also closely tracks the ascent of brash software genius Cameron, played by Mackenzie Davis, and Gordon's wife Donna, played by Carrie Bechet, two brilliant women in a male-dominated industry decades from reckoning. The foursome's interlocking personal professional lives transform in unusual ways, and what initially looks like Mad Men in the medium high-tech 80s sprawls forward into a strange new era. AMC's wondrous workplace drama has a slow start reputation, partially because seasons 3 and 4 improved into 2 of the best TV seasons ever. But even the early episodes have a quirky charm, capturing an already lost world at the dawn of the personal computing age. Did I mention laser tag? Did I mention the Blue Man Group, our special guest stars? Halt whatever you're doing and catch fire. That was our editor's letter, the weekly dispatch email that I get. And now I'm going over to the magazine. The article I was reading last week was called Failure to Launch. Every TV pilot season, some shows soar while others crash and burn before ever making it to the screen. Here we revisit 7 that never got to fly. I'm not going to read the whole article again, but the first ones that I read were Cruel Intentions, The Corrections, How I Met Your Dad, Cagney and Lacey, and DeBrick. And we have 2 more shows. This one is called Pretty Handsome. It was from 2008. The show was going to be on FX. The director, Ryan Murphy, and the writers, Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk. It was starring Joseph Fiennes, Carrie Ann Moss, Sarah Paulson, and Alexandra Billings. If there's one thing Ryan Murphy is good at, it's producing provocative shows. But this 2008 project may have been ahead of its time. I loved it. It tested through the roof, he recalled, at a 2018 GQ event. Then I got a call from the network saying advertisers would not support this. This was a dramedy pilot about a white, upper-middle-class patriarch realizing they are a trans woman. The show came 6 years before Amazon's groundbreaking comedy Transparent, created by Joey Soloway. Actress Alexandra Billings appeared in both. Transparent was owned by trans people, she says, whereas that wasn't true of Pretty Handsome. Billings initially thought Murphy was aloof and was put off by a scene where Joseph Fiennes, gynecologist protagonist, stares at her genitals. Learning it led to a fantasy sequence where he begins to find his transness. She found Murphy's justification of the moment to be beautiful. Murphy was not available for comment. Today, Billings applauds Murphy for Pose and for being someone who is not only making queer-centric art, but who also opens the door to the trans experience and allows us to do our thing. That was by Marcus Jones. And then our last pilot that didn't launch is the Game of Thrones prequel. The year was 2018 on HBO. The creative team was S.J. Clarkson, director, Jane Goldman, showrunner, and Jane Goldman was also the writer. It starred Naomi Watts and Naomi Ecki. The sets were extraordinary. That's the one thing we know for sure about HBO's mysterious, never-seen Game of Thrones prequel pilot starring Naomi Watts. The ill-fated project, often called The Long Night or Blood Moon, though neither title was ever official, was ordered to pilot in 2018 and featured the King Kong actress as a socialite with a secret, in a tale set thousands of years before the events of Game of Thrones. An insider says one set constructed in Northern Ireland for the pilot was of the Stark Ancestral Hall, except more primitive and Viking-esque. Another was a towering cliffside in the future Lannister seat of Casterly Rock, with multiple levels where actors could perform. Despite HBO's determination to find a Game of Thrones successor, the project was shelved. The biggest challenge was building a new fantasy world and characters from scratch. Author George R.R. Martin hadn't written more than a couple paragraphs about the show's era. That prequel was 8,000 years before the current show, so it required a lot more invention, HBO Chief Content Officer Casey Bloys noted in a Variety interview last year. Some fans have speculated that HBO may have cooled on the idea, chronicling another build-up to a war with the White Walkers, given the mixed reaction to the wintry The Long Night episode in Game of Thrones' final season. The Ironborn say that what is dead may never die, but this pilot won't rise again. That was by James Hibbard. And here's a side note, shows that scrapped their original pilot but went on to great success. Three's Company on ABC, The Incredible Hulk on CBS, Full House on ABC, Perfect Strangers on ABC, and also Home Improvement on ABC, Buffy the Vampire Slayer on the WB, Charmed, also on the WB, The King of Queens on CBS, 30 Rock on NBC, The Big Bang Theory on CBS, Game of Thrones on HBO, and Man with a Plan on CBS. We're going to the TV section here in the reviews area. The article is called Lights, Camera, Antibacterial Wipes. 1 year after the COVID-19 pandemic caused a production shutdown, the TV industry is grappling with an expensive and anxiety-ridden new normal on set. This is by Lynette Rice. Since the pandemic began, more than 5 million COVID-19 tests have been performed in Los Angeles County. Marla Hudnall has taken at least 37 of them. As a second assistant director for shows on both broadcast and premium cable, Hudnall is required to get tested 3 times a week to keep sets safe. If she's due for a test on her day off, Hudnall, like her union colleagues, earns $250 for her time. But even with the constant swabbing, layers of protective equipment, and special work zones to limit who's on set at any one time, the virus still found its way into our workplace. One of my shows actually did go down for 2 weeks because we had somebody test positive, recalls Hudnall. That person had enough interaction with actors that all of our actors had to go into quarantine. We ran out of things to shoot. It's been 1 year since Hollywood ground to a halt in an effort to slow the spread of the virus that has now killed more than 400,000 people in the U.S. as of press time. TV shows stopped making new episodes and seasons were cut short, leading to an estimated $3 billion loss in ad revenue. After a 4-month shutdown, production slowly began ramping back up. Shows including The Bachelorette, Big Brother, and The Bold and the Beautiful had resumed shooting as of July, followed by The Witcher, Wheel of Fortune, Supernatural, and many others in August. Though periodic shutdowns persisted through the fall, the TV industry adjusted with strict precautions to keep cast and crew safe. Then came a new surge of cases after the holidays, and production was once again put on hold at the beginning of 2021. As the virus continues to rage in Los Angeles County, which was averaging more than 10,000 new cases a day as of press time, the only thing the TV business can count on is that its new normal is extremely fragile. This was and is a fast-moving and developing situation in Southern California, explains David White, the executive director of the Screen Actors Guild. We are continually monitoring the situation to ensure the safest possible work environment for our members. Rob Korn, an executive producer on Fox's medical drama, The Resident, admits there's a lot of unease on set. I don't think any show has fully adapted to all the COVID protocols. We all know it's inevitable that positive tests are going to appear, so it's a matter of keeping the crew emotionally healthy. I do know that people are scared. Everything about shooting during the pandemic is stressful. Still, that's no excuse for screaming at your underlings, stares pointedly at Tom Cruise. Compounding the anxiety are the added costs. It's not cheap to maintain a COVID-free environment, especially if a set is forced to shut down after someone tests positive. Even if you get a false positive, because those do happen, it's actually faster and easier to just do the 14-day quarantine, because even false positives get reported to the CDC, explains Hudnall. So all of a sudden, you're having to jump through a gajillion hoops just to get permission to shoot again. And it will still take, like, 14 days. So you might as well just all go into quarantine. To prevent such worst-case scenarios, TV studios spend anywhere from $250,000 to $1 million per episode to protect their productions from the virus. In addition to outfitting cast and crew with personal protective equipment, like masks and face shields, sets are now divided into colored or numbered zones, such as red for filming and blue for lighting changes in rehearsal, and neither group is allowed to interact. Green zones are for drinking and snacking, activities that require mask removal, while sit-down meals happen away from the set and with social distancing rules in place. When it comes to producing TV in the COVID era, bigger can be better. Case in point, ABC's Supermarket Sweep took over an airport hangar in Santa Monica so they could recreate a grocery store and give everyone enough room to socially distance. Yo, they were not effing around, says host Leslie Jones. We were getting tested 3 times a week. No one could come near me without a face mask and a shield on their face. And even when they came to me, I had to wash my hands. Every time I touched anything, they were sanitizing me. The meals, everybody sat 6 feet from me. That's why it was so good for us to have the hangar, because we were able to do the lunch tables where we were separating people. Making sure people can eat and drink safely has been the biggest challenge, says Hudnall. One of the actors on one of my shows threw up from sun exposure and dehydration because he wasn't drinking enough. He was fully kitted up and running up and down a mountain. In order to eat or drink anything, you have to be able to step away to a green zone or a mask relief area. It's just hard. And for now, there's no end in sight. Fans should expect fewer episodes of their favorite shows. Most series will be lucky to finish 16 or 18 episodes for the 2020 to 2021 season, rather than the standard 22. But the industry is trying to look at the bright side. At least they were able to make something during this incredibly challenging time. It was crazy and, yes, very stressful, says Jones. These people really wanted this show to happen, and they got in there and made it happen. It was absolutely beautiful. And our sidebar here is TV copes with COVID, a timeline. March 2020. On March 11th, WHO declared COVID-19 a pandemic, and TV productions began shutting down around the globe. The same day, Tom Hanks announced that he and wife Rita Wilson had tested positive for COVID. July 2020, reality shows, including The Bachelorette, resumed shooting. Filming started up in a bubble at Tyler Perry's Atlanta studio. August 2020, broadcast networks began putting their scripted series back to work. Meanwhile, late-night hosts James Corden and Stephen Colbert returned to shooting in studio after producing their shows remotely since March. September 2020, a second wave of shutdowns began. ABC's For Life suspended shooting after multiple people working on the show tested positive. Several CW series, including Riverdale, were put on hold due to delayed COVID test results. November 2020, production on Netflix's fantasy hit The Witcher shut down for a second time due to coronavirus infections. Many other shows, including NBC's Chicago Fire, also had to pause filming when staffers tested positive. And January 2021, as daily COVID tests hit record highs in Los Angeles, Netflix and multiple studios, including Warner Brothers TV, CBS Studios, and Sony Pictures TV, pushed their post-holiday shooting schedules back to mid-month. So that was all about the coronavirus and how they're handling it in TV land. It was called Lights, Camera, Antibacterial Wipes, and it was by Lynette Rice. Party Time. Sci-fi's cult western, Wynonna Earp, returns from its pandemic-imposed hiatus with a wild celebration. This is by Chancellor Agard. Wynonna Earp, sci-fi's salty supernatural drama, hopes to lift fan spirits when it returns for the back half of its fourth season, March 5th. "We're coming back with some much-needed fun," says showrunner Emily Andrus. Last we saw the scrappy series, season 4A ended in August as the cast finished shooting with the remaining episodes under COVID-19 safety protocols in Calgary. A rift had formed between Melanie Scrofano's titular demon hunter and her love interest, immortal cowboy Doc Holliday, played by Tim Rosen, casting a shadow over an otherwise joyful occasion. Winona's half-angel sister, Waverly, played by Dominique Provost-Chockley, finally got engaged to her longtime girlfriend, Nicole Hott, played by Catherine Verrill. Even though Winona and Doc's estrangement is far from resolved when season 4B begins, that's not going to stop the show from hitting a nightclub for the happy couple's bachelorette party. But in classic Winona Earp fashion, the night doesn't go as planned. "It's a little bit of our A Midsummer Night's Dream episode," teases Andrus. "The party is not necessarily what Waverly and Nicole would have picked for themselves, but there's certainly a lot of fun to be had. It will celebrate their love in an unexpected way." Alas, Andrus is cagey about whether we'll see a wedding this season. "Everyone is certainly working toward that goal," she says, "but we have some fairly huge obstacles and villains we may have to face down to see if we're even allowed to do one." That was Party Time by Chancellor Gard. It's a Sin. This is a Q&A in a riveting new HBO Max limited series. Five friends are rocked by the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s London. Writer-creator Russell T. Davies tells Entertainment Weekly why the subject and setting spoke to him. This is by Jared Hall. The first question is, what did you want to say here that hasn't been covered in other movies and series about the AIDS epidemic? "I had things to say that I felt hadn't quite been done. I haven't seen it from a street level, and I haven't seen it set within Britain. The passage of time was important to me. This takes place over 10 years, from 1981 to 1991. That's the nature of the virus. It's slow and it feeds. It takes many forms, and even death itself isn't predictable." The next question is, Ollie Alexander, as Richie, leads this ensemble cast. Why was he right for the role? I assume it's not because he's lead singer of Years and Years, and you created the series Years and Years. Exactly. That was the first thing we said to each other. We've been getting each other's emails by mistake. We did audition him. You don't sign up someone famous and hope they're good. And within about 10 seconds, I was sitting there going, oh, this is it. I literally wanted to run after him down the corridor when he was done and tell him that he had the part. But that's never true. Whenever you read actors saying they offered it to me on the spot, no, they didn't. Because you have to clear it with 57 people in charge of the money. He does sing a bit. Did you incorporate that once you had Ollie, or was that always in the script? That's just by chance. But I almost thought about not doing it because he's a singer. In the 1980s, everyone sang at men's clubs to get their actor's equity card. What's the backstory of the title? It was originally The Boys, and we knew that the Amazon show, The Boys, was on the horizon. We were quite selfish and clung to our title. Eventually, HBO Max said, don't be ridiculous. We can't advertise something with the same title as another channel. I was thinking, what can we do? Oh, it's a Sin. It was a line in episode 4. It's also a Pet Shop Boys song and a very old song from the 1930s called It's a Sin to Tell a Lie, which sums up the whole feeling of being in the closet. And it wasn't a sin. The article was called It's a Sin. It was a Q&A with writer-creator Russell T. Davies talking to Jared Hall. Farewell, DuckTales. Disney's smartly silly genre-bending adventure was a standout wonder of the revival age. This is by Darren French. In the marvelously satisfying DuckTales series finale, the cast assembles one last time. Scrooge McDuck, voiced by David Tennant, and his nephews, heroic super ducks with gizmos or dark wigs, a teen sorceress who used to be a witch's shadow, the headless man horse, I could go on, There are sacred Disney creations from Walt's lifetime alongside snarky 90s spoofs and soulful new millennium weirdos. Yes, this was DuckTales, a relentlessly fun family adventure that treated decades of cultural history like an infinite toy box. The series ends in March with a 90-minute extravaganza. Its final season could do any kind of story. Eternal lover rivals on spring break, super team showdowns, a nightmarish sitcom parody, that Yuletide duel with literal Santa. Excuse me, we are the science guys, Hero Gearloose, voiced by Jim Rash, says in the finale. You must be looking to fight the magic guys? Science and magic backdropped a duck blur of visual gags, fantastic dialogue, and never annoying self-awareness. My favorite character was Louie, voiced by Bobby Monahan. Formerly just the green one, and now a larcenous convoy. No, my favorite character was Della, voiced by Paget Brewster, Scrooge's long-lost niece, unstoppably gung-ho even after a long decade cast away on the moon. Who am I kidding? You can't beat Webby, voiced by Kate Micucci, a hero-worshipping heroine who could turn the littlest thing into a mythic quest. The all-star voices told a tale. Danny Pudi and Ben Schwartz played Huey and Dewey, respectively, both actors' presence signposting how Neo-DuckTales honored the cult comedy absurdity of Community and Parks and Recreation. Perhaps another kids' cartoon will guest star Giancarlo Esposito, Allison Janney, Edgar Wright, and Natasha Rothwell, but that show won't have Don Cheadle occasionally voicing Donald Duck. A late episode features Adam Pally as Kit Cloudkicker, Tailspin's sky surfer all grown up into a slacker with money problems. That subplot epitomizes how showrunners Matt Youngberg and Francisco Agones layered nostalgia with misfit toy poignance. A notably diverse perspective conjured sweet romance for Lin-Manuel Miranda's Gizmo Duck and revealed with Who Cares aplomb that brainy Violet Sabrewing, voiced by Libby Bearer, had two dads. It helped and hurt that DuckTales didn't fit any larger corporate strategy, moving from Disney XD to the Disney Channel and back. You need a magical map to find it, and then Disney Plus launched with this very serialized saga's episodes out of order. Too many missed DuckTales in its first run, but that just makes it the reboot era's great hidden gem, awaiting discovery in the corrected streaming archive. And aren't the best treasures always buried? That was Farewell DuckTales by Darren French. Embrace the binge. Get ready for some tough love, streaming networks. Your hodgepodge of release patterns is awful, and it's time for a change. This is by Kristen Baldwin. Life can be hard. TV should be easy. And yet, too many streaming networks continue to resist the clearly superior binge model for their shows. Listen up. HBO Max, Hulu, Amazon Prime, and the rest, to paraphrase Frank Costanza, I've got a lot of problems with your mismatch of release patterns, and now you're gonna hear about it. It's been nearly a decade since the term binge-watching entered our cultural lexicon, thanks to Netflix. What a gift to get hooked on a new show and not have to wait 7 days, 7 minutes, or even 7 seconds for the next episode. Netflix knew if you wanted to change how people watch TV and make them pay for the privilege, you've got to give them some incentive. And streamers have a unique and powerful advantage over traditional television. They're not beholden to advertisers, time slots, schedules, or other remnants of the fading broadcast TV model. Still, as the clown car-esque boom of streaming platforms continues, only one, Peacock, with its vast library of NBCU content, was confident enough to follow NBC's lead on an all-binge model for their scripted shows. Today, coherent release pattern strategies are rare. HBO Max, Hulu, and Apple TV Plus seem to decide at random which shows will arrive all at once, which will go weekly, and which will drop in chunks over several weeks. Pop quiz, do the numbers 3, 2, 2, 1 represent the flight attendant's release schedule on HBO Max, or the first 4 digits of pi? Here's why this is so infuriating. People are flooded daily with new streaming options, and good shows risk being washed away in a content tsunami. Streamers of the world, if you have a show you believe in, give viewers the option to watch it on their schedule. If only Apple TV Plus would do that with Servant, the gorgeous cliffhanger-driven horror noir from M. Night Shyamalan. It would make an excellent binge, but Apple TV insists on releasing it weekly, a momentum-killing decision that likely explains why you have never seen Servant. Ditto for The Good Fight, a brilliant, bingeable prestige drama hindered by CBS All Access, which will be rebranded as Paramount Plus on March 4th, which treats all of its shows like they're on CBS. And Amazon, which irritated fans last year by releasing The Boys Season 2 weekly, had a word-of-mouth binge hit in December with its young adult survival drama, The Wilds. Calm down, Disney Plus, I hear you over there shouting. We turned The Mandalorian into an event by releasing episodes weekly. Yes, that's absolutely true. It's also true, though, that fans have been waiting 15 years for a live-action Star Wars TV show. Of course they're willing to watch it weekly. Few shows, if any, have that kind of leverage. A message for every other streamer that isn't wrapped in the cozy cloak of the MCU Lucasphere: stop forfeiting your platform superpower and unleash the binge. That was Embrace the Binge by Kristen Baldwin, and we have a sidebar here called Streamer Scorecard Hidden Gems Edition. Think you've watched everything good on Netflix and the like? Nope. Put these shows on your binge list. This is also by Kristen Baldwin. On Netflix, you want to binge Stateless, Last Chance You, and Everything Sucks. Those are three shows. On Hulu, the three shows are 11-22-63, that's a date, 10-15, and Casual. On Apple TV Plus, Little America, Servant, and Dickinson. On Amazon, you want to watch Patriot, Undone, and One Mississippi. And CBS All Access, you want to binge The Good Fight, The Good Fight, and The Good Fight. Wow, this has all been really good stuff so far. In fact, I'm even late for my halfway point of letting you know that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I'm reading from the March issue of Entertainment Weekly. Our next article is also from the TV category, Kelly's Major Milestone. She won the coveted vacant seat next to Regis Philbin in winter 2001. Now Kelly Ripa's celebrating 20 years on Live. This is by Jared Hall. Kelly Ripa never ever thought about becoming a morning talk show mainstay. Yet 2 decades after replacing Kathy Lee Gifford as Regis Philbin's co-host on the iconic Live, Ripa is still going strong on the Rise and Shine perennial, with 5 Daytime Emmy Awards for Outstanding Host to boot. It happened to me by accident, the one-time soap star 50 recalls. While appearing on All My Children, she was asked to fill in on Live for a guest host who had a family emergency. In the process, Ripa instantly became a frontrunner to replace Gifford. She immediately lit up the room, and we knew there was something special, explains EP Michael Gelman. There was a certain charisma and humor and quickness that was really innate. Because she wasn't an experienced broadcaster at the time, she just had that it factor. She still does. After 4,000 live episodes and the same number of famous host chats after countless celebrity interviews and Halloween costumes, after learning how to ride a bike and facing her fear of roller coasters on air, after the departure of Philbin in 2011, his final show was significant. We were terrified, she recalls. And then his replacement, Michael Strahan, leaving in 2016. She was very much considering retirement, says Ryan Seacrest. I'm happy she didn't. For her part, Ripa credits her current co-host's enthusiasm and his excitement for changing her mind. The two of us are partners, she says. There's this energy between us because we both appreciate the amount of work that goes into making a show look effortless. Likely for many more years to come. That was Kelly's Major Milestone by Jared Hall. We'll wrap up the What to Watch article. I've mentioned it in previous episodes. This is your guide to March's essential viewing, and we are wrapping up March, so you can know that on Monday, March 22nd, Independent Lens has Coded Bias on PBS. That's on PBS. Tuesday, the 23rd, there's a series debut, Demi Lovato, Dancing with the Devil. That's on YouTube. We already heard about that. On the 26th, it's Godzilla vs. Kong on HBO Max. Stream it or see it in the theater? Your call. We hate to pit things against each other. There's a series debut also called Invincible on Amazon Prime Video. Robert Kirkman's animated coming of superhero drama boasts an insane cast. J.K. Simmons, Steven Yeun, Mahershala Ali, Lauren Cohen, Nicole Breyer, John Hamm, Seth Rogen. If only we had room to mention Mark Hamill, Zachary Quinto, Clancy Brown, Mae Whitman, Walton Goggins, Andrew Rannells, and Sonequa Martin-Green. Oh, and Michael. Alien Nation, Hulu comedy Solar Opposites, which returns March 26, focuses on a family of extraterrestrials who crash-landed on Earth. Here are seven notable sitcoms, one for each decade, that feature an alien among us. 1963 to 1966 was My Favorite Martian. 1978 to 1982 was Mork and Mindy. ALF was 1986 to 1990. We watched Third Rock from the Sun, 1996 to 2001. American Dad, we've been watching since 2005. And The Neighbors, 2012 to 2014. We heard about shows to binge earlier. Here are three more to binge. Miss Your Office? Try these hidden gem workplace comedies from the past decade. Better Off Ted, that aired 2009 to 2010. You can watch it on Hulu. At Viridian Dynamics, pumpkins are weaponized, and a glacial boss, played by Portia de Rossi, can cut through any surface. Absurd antics abound in the R&D department as Better Off Ted cleverly punctures the we care veneer of corpo culture. Teamwork, it keeps our employees gruntled. That was by Dan Snyerson. W1A, that was 2014 through 2017, and you can watch it on Netflix. Admin blather abounds in this sprightly Britcom set inside the BBC. Hugh Bonneville stars as an executive who values the idea of valuing values. And a madcap ensemble makes W1A the rare lighthearted Orwellian satire. That was by Darren French. And great news. You can watch that on Netflix. It aired 2017 to 2018. The charming, biting cable news comedy showcases Andrea Martin as a boundary-busting intern obsessed with her producer daughter, played by Brigha Helan, and John Michael Higgins as a puffed-up anchor with a big secret in his closet. It's not what you think, dummy. It's a dummy. That was also by Dan Snyerson. In their heading called Entertaining Weekly, this month culinary inspiration comes by the way of your favorite TV and film stars. This is by Ruth Kinane. Under the heading of Playing with Food, Jesse Tyler Ferguson. The Modern Family actor, Broadway star, and co-author of Food Between Friends, 45, answers Entertainment Weekly's burning culinary questions. The first one is, if you had to identify as a type of cheese, which would it be? And his response is, I would be string cheese because I haven't had a haircut in a while, and that's sort of the state of my hair right now. Which three fictional guests would you invite to a dinner party? Meryl Streep as Julia Child, because I have always wanted to meet Julia Child, so this would be the next best thing. Meryl Streep as Miranda Priestley, and the Muppet, who is also a chef. That's the Swedish chef. If you could have dinner with any three real people, dead or alive, who would they be? Kamala Harris, Michelle Obama, and Joan Rivers. What is your favorite food scene from pop culture? I love that scene in Schitt's Creek when Moira, played by Catherine O'Hara, and David, played by Dan Levy, are trying to make enchiladas. They're both terrible in the kitchen, and they're trying to fold in the cheese and can't figure out what the term means. It's like the blind leading the blind. You're a stage darling, so taste binge trash, Broadway edition. A real nice clam bake from Carousel, Bruce Bogtrotter's chocolate cake from Matilda the Musical, mermaid marshmallow pie from The Waitress. I'm going to put the chocolate cake in the trash because I'm not a huge fan. I'll eat it if it's put in front of me, mind you, but I have two other things to choose from. I'll taste the pie and binge the clam bake. Your favorite music to cook to? I like to listen to jazz in the kitchen. I'll say, Alexa, play jazz music. And for some reason, she plays the same compilation every time. If you were in a food fight, what would be your weapon of choice? I feel like everyone would choose some sort of meringue pie, so I would probably go with spaghetti and meatballs. And the last question is, name a condiment you can't live without. And he says, sriracha. That was their interview with Jesse Tyler Ferguson. Their recipe this month, they're calling it Slice Slice Baby. Make the dark days of winter a little lighter, literally, with this super healthy za. Vegetable pizza. Your ingredients for the sauce, this is a Sicilian tomato sauce, 2 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, 3 garlic cloves minced, 1/2 teaspoon Himalayan pink salt, 2 teaspoons freshly ground pepper, 1 24-ounce can of crushed tomatoes, 3 ounces of tomato paste, 2 teaspoons fresh rosemary chopped, 2 teaspoons fresh basil chopped, 1 whole clove, a pinch of red pepper flakes, and 1/2 teaspoon of pure maple syrup. For the pizza dough, you want 1.5 cups almond flour, 1 cup arrowroot powder plus more for dusting, 1/2 teaspoon Himalayan pink salt, 1/4 cup coconut yogurt, and 1/2 cup unsweetened almond milk. And for toppings, 1/2 a medium zucchini thinly sliced, 1/4 red onions thinly sliced, 1/4 cup pitted black olives halved, 1 bell pepper seeded, cored, and diced, a pinch of that pink Himalayan salt, and 2 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil. So you make the sauce by heating the olive oil in a medium saucepan over medium heat. When the oil is shimmering, add the garlic and toast it very lightly. They say here about 30 minutes, but I think they mean 30 seconds, definitely 30 seconds or less. Reduce heat to low and add salt, black pepper, tomatoes, tomato paste, rosemary, basil, clove, red peppers, and your maple syrup, along with 1 cup of water. Cover and simmer for about an hour until the sauce is bubbling and thickened. Remove the clove and, if desired, blend the sauce in a high-speed blender until smooth. Then place a pizza stone or inverted baking sheet directly on the oven rack while it preheats. The baking sheet will get very hot and provide a crispy bottom crust. Make the dough. In a medium bowl, combine the almond flour, arrowroot, and salt. Slowly stir in coconut yogurt and almond milk and mix until a soft dough forms. It'll take about a minute. On a counter, place the dough on a sheet of parchment paper. Cover with another piece of parchment paper and gently roll it out into a large circle about 10 inches in diameter and 1/8 of an inch thick. Pinch the edge of the pizza dough into a small lip all the way around, then spoon the sauce over the dough, sprinkle with zucchini, onion, olives, pepper, and salt, and then drizzle with the olive oil, but not the lip of the pizza. Bake it for 15 minutes or until the crust is deep golden brown at the edges. It makes 1 10-inch pizza, and this was adapted from Sweet Laurel Savory by Laurel Gallucci and Claire Thomas. The book says it's everyday decadence for whole food, grain-free meals. Those recipes go really fast on this recording, but you can always play it back through our podcast area. The next article is called A Need to Know Basis. Need inspiration to make your own pie? Take in these mouth-watering pop culture pizza moments. This is by Cesia Rankin. The Joey special. This was on Friends. There are certain elements of Joey Tribbiani's, played by Matt LeBlanc, culinary lifestyle that should rightly be avoided. See peanut butter fingers and expired orange juice. But his famous two-pizza order is what we all deserve, especially now. The guilt-free margarita from Eat, Pray, Love. The only thing more delicious than Neapolitan pizza is Neapolitan pizza served without a care in the world. Take it from Liz Gilbert, played by Julia Roberts. Have a relationship with your pie, embrace the muffin top, and get some bigger jeans. The Sal's Boycott from Do the Right Thing. Leave it to Spike Lee to use a pizzeria to explore racial tensions and prejudices in his 1989 masterpiece. While we'll always covet a classic New York slice, this pie is best taken with knowledge of Brooklyn's complicated history. And the Pizza Shotgun on 30 Rock. Liz Lemon is a culinary trailblazer. She invented night cheese. She's brave enough to ask a suitor for free mozzarella sticks instead of a drink. And she can shotgun an entire very large pie with this impressive move. And the picture that they're showing is Liz Lemon, the character Liz Lemon from 30 Rock, that has folded up an entire pizza, and she's trying to eat it like she would a slice that you typically fold and eat. I promised Billie Eilish, so let's go over to the features section for the article called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. From Billie Eilish to Demi Lovato and Taylor Swift, the music documentary is undergoing a fascinating, intimate overhaul. We go inside the transformation. This is by Marcus Jones. Billie Eilish knew what she was getting herself into. I grew up loving documentaries like Believe and Never Say Never amidst the 19-year-old music phenom, referencing Justin Bieber's popular concert films. So when a camera crew showed up at her childhood home in Los Angeles in 2018 to film a documentary about the making of her debut album, she welcomed them with open arms, if not exactly optimism. My entire family and I thought, it's never going to actually come out, she says. It has been pretty insane and surreal since. Billie Eilish's When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? Emerged as a multi-platinum Grammys sweeping smash, rendering the resulting film, The World's a Little Blurry, not only a reality, but also highly anticipated. Its release, February 26th on Apple TV Plus, falls just a few weeks after the 10-year anniversary of when fans like Eilish sat eagerly in a movie theater and helped make Bieber's first film, Never Say Never, the highest-grossing music documentary of all time, nearly $100 million globally, thereby ushering in a new wave. The decade since has been other A-list musicians like Beyoncé, Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, Travis Scott, and more participate in films of a similar nature. The decade since has seen other A-list musicians like Beyoncé, Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, Travis Scott, and more participate in films of a similar nature, focusing on their personal lives, with a particular boon occurring over the past year. Philosophically, the question of why global superstars agree to have cameras follow them around for a year, give or take, is difficult to answer. But Scott Manson, chief operating officer of music management company SV Projects, offers a pragmatic reason. The executive producer of the 2020 docs YouTube Originals Justin Bieber Next Chapter and Netflix's Ariana Grande Excuse Me, I Love You, says typically they are built around a moment or a phase of the artist's career that is really core to the artist, first and foremost. To capture, the artist will either come to us with the moment or the moment will be obvious in terms of the impact and the scale. According to one veteran film finance executive, it's exciting for the artists to work independently because they have more control, if also a long wait before they see any financial benefits. Although there are certain economic incentives for some of these artists, they aren't being paid like in a casting, adds a source who's worked on high-profile music docs. There's no on-camera fee. That's a big distinction. By way of that, these narratives are being driven by third parties. Maybe they're a filmmaker, maybe they're a financier, or creative producer who sees an opportunity. And in the interest of the artists they represent, Manson adds that SV Projects often shoots exploratory footage until the aforementioned moment or phase that calls for a full documentary. We always avoid pitching something that isn't completely baked creatively, he says, even if there's a bidding war, we don't want to put our artists in a position in which they're jammed into delivering a story that they're not inspired by or they don't have creative control over. When the time comes to partner with a director to clarify that vision, it's all about trust. Summoned for a preliminary meeting with Eilish, filmmaker R.J. Cutler from the September issue was struck by how the singer's incredibly warm family was so welcoming upon his first visit. It was very easy for me to be comfortable with them. He and the young star knew that day they were meant to make a movie together. If it's easy for everybody to be themselves in the first meeting, you have a sense there's something there, Cutler says, and adds Eilish, he was really sweet. He walked through his plan, something about it fit, and it made sense. On the other end of the spectrum, singer Demi Lovato, whose new YouTube Originals series, Dancing with the Devil, premieres March 23rd, had known the director, Michael D. Ratner, for years before they decided to work together. I met him as a friend first, Lovato says, so when we started, I trusted him already. I didn't have to work on getting comfortable. By the time I sat down to talk about what I had been through, it had been 2 years, and I was ready to tell the world everything. The better connection, the more intimacy and trust, adds the aforementioned source. A lot of these subjects, you talk to them after they film the doc, and their relationships to the filming and the filmmaker are much different than at the beginning. In many instances, the subject is almost surprised that they revealed certain things. In that sense, becoming a cinematic subject has all but replaced in-depth magazine cover stories and network TV sit-downs as an avenue for artists to reveal themselves in a new light. You don't necessarily know what the journalist is going to write about you, but oftentimes here, you're mending an artist who's telling their stories with another artist who has final cut on that story, says Manson. While it isn't directly analogous to traditional journalism, the musician putting trust into the filmmaker has created this sort of magical creative sandbox for filmmakers to interact with the global superstars who are also artists and see how they collaborate. Lovato, for instance, felt a sense of ownership over the story Ratner was telling via the docuseries. I was able to create the accurate narrative of what happened to me without being worried that it would be edited by a press or news outlet, she explains. If artists find the medium ideal for avoiding press, then distributors see it as a fast pass toward front page news. Indeed, you may have noticed all of the aforementioned projects found splashy homes on streaming platforms. All the streamers use the same expression, which is creating the cultural moment, says the knowledgeable source. How do we create a cultural moment around the Jonas Brothers? You drop the album simultaneously with the first documentary. You have a follow-up documentary 2 years later, and you do it on a global streamer. Streaming is no longer a pejorative means of distribution. Streamers also have cash to burn. Apple reportedly spent $25 million to acquire Cutler's Eilish film. Michael John Warren, who has directed nonfiction projects centered on Jay-Z and Nicki Minaj, including a forthcoming HBO Max docuseries on the latter, adds that streaming partnerships also benefit the filmmakers. There's a little bit more freedom to experiment, to really do what you want to do, he says. I don't want to say the stakes are lower, but if you were putting something on prime time on MTV 10 years ago, MTV would have been like, okay, this is the only thing we have on air tonight at 8 o'clock. Meanwhile, look at what Netflix does. They're not just trying to become a television network, they're trying to become television. That's their thing. They're so wide. As more streaming services launch and hope to attract new customers, Manson asks, what better way to market your subscription-based platform than to offer millions of existing potential future subscribers an intimate look at their idols? Head of YouTube Originals Suzanne Daniels also promises flexibility. Sometimes we're presented with a job that's completed, and it's a bidding war, she says, but sometimes people come to us with something that's partially finished. That was the case with our Johnny Cash documentary, The Gift, from 2019. We acquired it based on what we saw, and then they finished it with us. And sometimes it's an initial pitch, like Justin Bieber's Seasons from 2020. We're right there with them from day one. It's no secret that these movies and series have exploded against the backdrop of COVID-19 and the resulting pause on live events. The pandemic has slowed down the speed at which everything moves, and that's probably given people more time to think about making a documentary, Warren says. Thinking of ways to connect with fans and inspire them while not being able to tour, musicians are asking themselves, what am I going to do now? Warren continues, they are artists. They have to have output. That's part of the thing that makes them happy, is to make stuff. The timing in the marketplace couldn't be better. There's definitely a global appeal and also an appetite, especially of the streamers, to tap into the magic and the existing fan bases of some of these big personalities, says Manson. SB Project's J Balvin documentary, The Boy from Medellin, which Amazon acquired last fall, exemplifies that possibility, with Oscar-nominated director Matthew Heineman from Cartelland following the reggaeton icon home to Colombia to perform at a soccer stadium. This all feels new, at least as a trend, but Cutler notes maybe it isn't. Citing revered music documentaries like Don't Look Back from 1965 and Gimme Shelter from 1970, which followed Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones, respectively, the world's a little blurry director sees a historical precedent. As he puts it, such classics asserted that these films could be commercial, that they could live on a big screen, that Mick Jagger was as worthy of being a star of a movie as Robert Redford was. That's the great tradition that many of us are working in, pursuing these films, he concludes. If you're looking for great subject matter, you don't have to look any further than Billie Eilish. That was extremely loud and incredibly close, and it was about the music documentary industry, and it was by Marcus Jones. And I think we have a few minutes to power through a couple book reviews here. The first one is No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. It's 208 pages. No One is officially billed as a novel, though Lockwood, she of the viral poem Rape Joke and fantastically outré 2017 memoir Priest Daddy, is hardly the kind of writer to be held to form. Her latest, accordingly, comes on in a swirl of internet age irony and remove, less stream of consciousness than a series of small, heady whirlpools. But when its unnamed protagonist's sister gives birth to a baby with a rare genetic disorder, those surreal fragments of social media flotsam and self-regard coalesce into something else, a story of real analog human feeling, both heartbreaking and stealthily profound. Leah Greenblatt rates No One Is Talking About This a B+. Our second book is Yolk, that's Y-O-L-K, by Mary H.K. Choi. It's 385 pages. The third novel from young adult author Choi, from Permanent Record, sneaks up on you with its insight and poignancy. When Jane's estranged sister June gets a dreaded diagnosis, the girls realize how desperately they've always needed each other. Though college-age Jane's often funny narration vacillates credibly between the conviction that she knows it all and terror that the world is beyond her grasp, her frequent pop culture references and odes to New York can grow tiresome and distracting. But when Choi focuses on her deeply human characters and their complex bonds, the sister's tale is undeniable. That's another B+ rating, this time from Mary Solosi. We did it. We got those last two in, and that brings us to the end of the episode this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please come back next week, and we will read more Entertainment Weekly. Goodbye.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Performances. The Midland Odessa Symphony Orchestra will perform Beethoven's 8th, formerly Tchaikovsky 4, for the finale of its Masterworks series, 7:30 p.m. April 10th at the Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center. Due to unforeseen circumstances, the title and program reportedly had to be changed, and Tchaikovsky 4 tickets will be honored for entrance into Beethoven's 8th. Masks are required for entrance, and seating will be socially distanced. Tickets start at $10 and can be purchased at mosc.org. Student tickets are free with a paying adult or valid college ID. For more information on MOSC events, visit mosc.org.